Hello, and welcome to Holton Village. Today is Wednesday, July 5th, 2000. In the fireside room this afternoon, we have Mary Scott Boria. Today's session number is SBM 2007, and is titled Social Justice, Transforming a Vision, Race Memories, A Step Toward Remembrances and Confession. Let's listen in.
You've thought about it a lot, like you can't let up on it.
Okay, so it's a journey we keep moving along on.
I think diversity might be the issue, socially, for us. And in my own work, I work on the concept of community and how that can be built within diversity.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very hard to come by practical ways to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm interested in.
Mm-hmm.
Some of our churches have not been open to it at all. I mean, just one kind of community.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to open up.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else?
We don't see much diversity. I live in a farm town, or somewhat of a farm town in Minnesota. And when faced with it, just kids, seems like they're just fooling around, but it's pretty bad actually. They don't no one realizes it because there's no one there to say, yeah, but I'm black, so why are you saying that? Because we don't have that.
Mm-hmm.
There's four black kids in our school or something.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask, was there anything about the topic today that was made you curious? Did you read the little thing?
Remind us again. What's the topic?
Yeah, okay. Well, then maybe if you didn't see it, then it didn't
peak
there.
No, I chose this one, but I just don't remember what it was.
Okay. Well, then I'll get into it in a second. I was just curious as was there anything in particular about how you saw the title.
This is a topic that's difficult to discuss without arousing guilt.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen many discussions where the arousal of guilt resulted in rejection.
Mm-hmm.
Don't want to talk about this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Tired of having somebody lay guilt trip.
Mm-hmm.
It's a verbal response.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you've been involved in dialogue or training. Who else here have been involved in some kind of formal training opportunities or group sessions around race?
A long time ago, I was very active in both CORE and SNCC.
Okay.
When I was in college.
Okay. Do you know Joe Bond?
No. I also specialized in the geography of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And spent time in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't talk earlier because I had peanut butter everywhere.
a little hard to.
Yeah. Well, one learns. People don't appreciate it. I've always, again, I came from a rural Midwest, which means white. And it always struck me that it's so stupid, racism. One of the ways that I discovered that denying people full participation because of a trait was stupid was when I came back from Africa. I was mostly in a Muslim area in northern Nigeria. And I was, this was in the early 60s, and I suddenly became aware that women did things here. In Nigeria, my nurse would have been a man.
Mm-hmm.
Women were severely restricted from education, from being teachers, as well as getting from commerce in a regular sense.
Mm-hmm.
I know that's not true in southern Nigeria, but it is in north.
Mm-hmm.
And I've engaged in a number of conversations about the status of women. And what I discovered is that I could pursue a conversation only up to a point, and then it would be as if I were trying to argue with Americans that 5-year-old kids should get the right to vote. And you would always come back and say, but they're kids. And that's what I would get in Northern Nigeria, but they're women. Mm-hmm. So a society that starts to change in the way of allowing everybody to be full participants strikes me as going in the rational way. Mm-hmm. And a society that says to a whole group of people, no, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. Stupid.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm interested in the issue of defining race. Mm-hmm. And the whole question of getting rid of that idea of race. Mm-hmm. So, treat that. Mm-hmm. I'm talking to you.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's lots of places to enter into this discussion, and as I've told every other group that I've talked to or been engaged with, it's hard to figure out the place to enter into the discussion. Because even those of you that have little contact or have had little contact in your life, in your home communities, in your churches, with people of color, are not removed from the issue of racism. I mean, there's no one in America that's so isolated from anyone else in the country that race doesn't impact us. Did you get one of these?
I didn't.
Oh, okay. And sometimes the degree to which it impacts us has almost little to do with the degree of exposure that we have. And so, you know, sometimes we enter in, you know, not having a lot of experiences, but our lives are shaped by this notion of race and racism in ways that we don't even know. And so it's often hard to kind of figure out where do we come in? Now I could do, and I can't, I could do a full training, a full discussion about racism, and it's hard to do. And I've said that it's hard to do. And an hour is a setup for you and for me. And so what I've tried to do is to sort of create a series of conversations that we use in the trainings that we do, and hope that it kind of offers, if not a snapshot, a series of chapter headings around race that you then can use in whatever way you feel you need. You're right. We need to figure out how to have conversation in this country about race. Sometimes the explosions are necessary. Sometimes we need to fight with each other in order to evoke the passion that gives us the energy to struggle and fight. Sometimes that's necessary. But I think we're beyond the period, because I can remember the period in which the guilt tripping ceased to have any more effectiveness. And so the strategies that people used to evoke that kind of emotion seem to kind of limit the ability to move us very far. However, I do think that guilt is the responsibility of the person who holds it and not the person who evokes it. And so there's a little bit of a two-way kind of, but I do think that we have to get to another place of dialogue. And so that's a challenge for all of us. What I have given you is kind of the scheme that I used this week I sort of did this last week, and then this week I thought, okay, let's see what kind of a scheme can I put this in. And so I kind of wanted to focus on some what I thought key aspects of the notion of racism were as a way to kind of think about a model that we use to help folks figure out where they are and where they need to go, where they'd like to go, and what sort of underpins this notion of racism. And to kind of do that instead of, I mean, I had thought about preparing a lot of facts and figures, but we all know what the scheme, we all know what racism looks like, right? I mean, we all know what race in this country has produced. And I will, you know, I can back into that a little bit, but I think it's, I don't know that I think it's useful to give you a bunch of facts and figures about how racism hurts people. We know that racism hurts people. And we know that in the year 2000, that racism continues to hurt people in very big ways. And so institutionally, we see that in my, it's not my favorite one, but the one that I think is probably most obvious to us, is the criminalization of a whole community of people. And the increase in crime, the increase in institutionalization as a result of crime, is in our faces all the time. So that's an example of racism, I think, at its worst. So to kind of have a whole group of statistics around how people of color are affected by the notion of race and racism in this country is constantly available to us. So I decided not to kind of go there. On Monday, we showed a video called Cosmic Slop. It's just was really kind of an interesting look at the possibility of people of color being exterminated in this country. It lifted up, I think, lots of examples of where race divides people in this country around health, education, lifestyle, all of those factors that we think about when we think about just quality of life and our life in this country. So we did a look at that. And so what I wanted to do was kind of think today about, again, sort of defining racism and defining kind of what the three, if you see on your page, sort of the power one, two, and three pieces of that are, and then kind of play that out a little bit today around the notion of race. Now, I know I said a whole lot, and you probably wonder, what did she just say? What did she say? I don't know what she said. I don't even know if I know what I said myself. But let me just ask a question, because what's the difference between diversity and racism? Looking at this through the lens of diversity and looking at this through the lens of racism. Because we use those concepts real interchangeably. I have some very specific, the ways in which we see race in this country is the way in which we approach ending racism. And so we use the words diversity and racism almost interchangeably. What do you think the difference is?
I think diversity makes a positive image and racism a negative one.
Okay.
So you use the differences for to celebrate, or you use the differences to build walls.
Okay.
One thing, racism seems like a preconceived idea, where diversity seems like you're open to learning.
Okay.
Diversity, I think, crosses racial. If you want to have racial categories, it doesn't necessarily have to do with race, whereas racism is, I think, essentializing people, stereotyping, essentializing.
Mm-hmm.
And diversity, it seems, celebrates our differences.
Mm-hmm.
Rather, racism separates us because of differences.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you're invited to a workshop on cultural diversities. What does that, What does that say to you? What are you going to do? You're invited to a workshop on cultural diversity. What are you anticipating is going to happen to you when you get there?
You'll be talking about different ethnic and linguistic groups, different religious groups. Maybe if they're really enlightened, they'll include gay and lesbian issues. And I would assume the assumption is that this is good, and so we want to encourage it, but that there will probably be problems associated with growing diversity.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anybody else?
I would think in a workshop on cultural diversity, I would expect to be challenged on my assumptions, mm-hmm. and so would people who differ from me, mm-hmm. so that you would open up some conscious realization that we differ in our upbringing and our views about mm-hmm. all kinds of things.
I think a workshop on diversity would show you how we're similar, what we have in common. Mm-hmm.
Because one of the things that happens in diversity is the possibility of conflict between cultural values. This is right, this is wrong. Mm-hmm. And if there's conflict, how do we resolve that? I don't hear that as part of the discussion that often. Mm-hmm.
Anybody else? So you're coming to a workshop on racism. What then are the thoughts that you have about what you expect to have happen?
It's a narrower topic than just cultural diversity, I think.
Yeah, I don't expect to discuss religious differences. Mm-hmm. I don't expect much in the way of ethnic differences. Mm-hmm.
So let's. I think the first opportunity, or the first thing that I want to tease out, is that sometimes these words, diversity and racism, mean something very different to us. And yet we use them oftentimes very interchangeably. And so what we expect to get from one, what I heard is what we expect to get from sort of diversity is we expect to get a sense of, you know, how we might find some commonalities, how we might celebrate our differences, how we might better understand each other as sort of cultural beings in society. And that is kind of, it kind of gives us sort of this hopefulness that, you know, by understanding each other better, we're able to sort of move beyond some of those things that cause us to have some tension. So that's kind of the notion of sort of cultural diversity. The notion of race, and looking at racism, lifts the hairs on our backs. I mean, it just sort of raises the hair on our arms, and I may want to go there, but I don't know if I want to go there. That may be a place I want to go, but I'm not quite sure, because that is about what has been negative about what has happened. And it's often been, I've been implicated in some kind of way. Either I've been accused of being a racist, or I've been accused of being limited, but that just somehow incriminates a whole group of people. And so there's a little skittish about kind of going there, because that's kind of, that keeps us sometimes stuck in where we've been in this country, whereas cultural diversity almost says it gives us a path out. Well, I guess I want to challenge us to think about that a little bit as we kind of unpack a little bit this notion. I find that when I Lots of people are making lots of big money in the cultural diversity field. I mean, you could charge $1,000 a day, and corporations and businesses and groups will pay you big bucks to come and talk about cultural diversity. Businesses are real big on it because as they become more international, of course, it's in their best interest. Their workforce is more diverse. It becomes something that is allows for a more sort of happy, productive workforce. If we can all, remember the Rodney King's phrase, if we could all just get along. And so the idea of sort of a multicultural idea of trying to figure out what creates a multicultural community is something that is about, that everybody wants to see happen. So then what I want to think about is I'm not doing a cultural diversity workshop. And actually my labels might have been a little misleading, at least for tomorrow. I'm not doing cultural diversity. And why am I not doing cultural diversity? Is race the same as culture?
No.
Okay. So we recognize that race is different. And so when I hear sort of, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about diversity, then I'm wondering if we're really clear sort of where we're going. Not that I don't think we should do that. I think it's a part of the process. But I'm focusing on racism. So what is racism? Somebody tell me what their notion of racism is. This is like a 2.5-day workshop in an hour. So.
It's using the definition. It's using the race of the person or of a group as a way of distinguishing them and probably lumping a prejudice to the whole group.
Okay.
And implicit in there is hierarchies of power.
Okay. Inferior and, okay.
So we got race, we got prejudice, and we got power, right? Now, many of you may have seen this definition, racism equals race, prejudice, plus power. It's something that is very commonly used by people who do racism work. And so each one of these words really kind of imply sort of something very significant in and of themselves. I'm going to try to focus a little bit more on race today. But what is prejudice? Tell me what you think prejudice is.
Assuming certain characteristics just because.
Okay. Exactly. Right. And without maybe even knowing anything, you just sort of, you know, sort of live with these prejudices.
Most of the time, it's also a negative perception.
Okay. Most of the time, but sometimes it could be positive.
Sometimes it can be.
It's usually based upon not knowing the facts and not having adequate information. So we're all capable of being prejudiced. I mean, we're all prejudiced beings. We live our lives striving not to be prejudiced, but we all are. We just are.
And I think it also contains an element of fear.
Okay.
We don't like whatever that prejudge idea is, so we fear that person.
Okay. So fear is attached to that. Okay.
It generalizes a stereotype. I mean, if you have one encounter with someone of a particular race, and that's a negative, then you can generalize and say all of these people are like this.
Exactly. So
you like all sweets are slow.
All sweets are done. That's what my grandmother said.
Well, let me just give you. I think were you with me last Friday? You were in that group last.
I was in some group last Friday, but I can't remember. Because
I'm going to tell some of the same stories. You might have heard already.
Well, I'm
up here with my husband and my grandkids, and my little grandson looks like a little white boy. He's a little white boy. And you wouldn't know it. And if you look at me and you look at him, you might look at me and say, I might be a white girl. I might be Latino. I might be anything. But you look at him and he looks like a little white boy. Well, he's pretty, active. He's like all other kids, you know. And he's, you know, he likes to climb, and he likes to get in trouble, and he likes to do things. And so coming up here, and I'll just, I'm African American, I don't know if people assume that, but coming up here and bringing him with me, I was really happy, to be quite honest, that he looked like a little white boy. Because my deep down feeling was, is that the minute he did something wrong, it wasn't going to be attributed to his race. That had he been an obviously looking person of color, then his acting out might have been attributed to a whole race of people. So that's how that, you're absolutely right, how it sort of get general. However, how racism works is it tends to work against groups, and it doesn't tend to work against the dominant society. So the fact that I would be happy that he's a little white, would look like a little white boy, is because if he acted up, it wouldn't be attributed to his race. It wouldn't be attributed to the fact that people think he's a little white kid. He's just a bad little boy. Have anything to do with the color of his skin, he's just a bad little boy. But as a person of color, it would be attributed to. See, they're all just like that. So anyway, right. So we have this sort of notion, and we're all sort of capable of being prejudiced. And then race prejudice is obviously attaching kind of this notion around races and who's raced and who's, you know, what that all means. But then when you add the element of power, so what is power? What does power mean when you said that? What were you thinking?
The group that is without power doesn't have access to economic mobility, doesn't have access to education, doesn't have access to political power. I mean, on all levels, a group is going to be disadvantaged.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, do you, who has, in this society, who has power? What is power then? Do you?
I
see a glare there, so yeah. I can't see you as well.
I'd like to add something sort of that. I think it can be that, those things too, but it can be something as simple as the way they're treated and spoken to,
mm-hmm.
and words that are said, and not just. Who owns companies and who can,
mm-hmm.
Who has the money.
Okay, so power can be both individual and institutional. And you're talking about individual and you're talking about institutional. Okay.
I think it's being able to make decisions that affect other people.
Okay.
Perhaps maybe.
Okay.
Without their choice.
Okay. So do you see that in any either of these two categories? Is that more one or the other? I mean, if you can make a decision that can affect a lot of people's lives, I mean, you might have a lot of individual power, but the ability to do that tends to come from support from some kind of institutional force or framework. I mean, a lot of people have a lot of individual power, but I mean, if that gets abused by an individual, there's always an institution that supports or sanctions the use or misuse of that. So power is something that we all have. We all have the ability to hurt each other, to say things, to do things. I mean, that's clear that we all, power is just the ability to act. You know, we think of power more often than not as negative, but power is positive as well. And we, you know, obviously there's, you know, sort of individual and institutional power. Well, the work that I do, we focus more on power sort of as a misuse of institutional, as a misuse of institutional power, if you can sort of say that. And that those who don't have power or those who don't have institution, what would we mean when we say institutional power? What does having institutional power mean? You know, a lot of us think we don't have no power. We have no power. I mean, we might have a little bit of power. We all have the power to say things that hurt. But for the most part, most of us think We're pretty powerless people.
It's to change the structures. You don't have the power to change the structures that do things that impact your life in a negative way. You have no power.
Okay.
So if you I'm thinking about the institutional racism of the church and how it keeps cropping up again. I work as a mentor for some a black woman who's getting through seminary in an alternate route. They've just changed the rules about that alternate route, and it impacts against the black students and in favor of both Hispanics and Asians. And it's interesting because I've tried to go in and find out about that, and even the black students don't see it. So I'm trying to say, well, let's talk about that, because I see this coming down the road. It's gonna affect you. It's gonna make it harder for black students to get into this program, mm-hmm. because it's more politically correct to have Hispanics now. But somebody's gotta fight the institution to make access possible for everybody equally. Mm-hmm.
So who has institutional power?
White men.
Tall white men. Okay, tall white men is who's,
tall white men.
Old tall white men. A couple of years ago, my husband and I were at a conference and we were showing this video, True Colors. I don't know if any of you have seen it. It just shows two testers, a black tester and a white tester, going around testing for discrimination. And it was a church conference. And so we just had the video playing and people would just walk by, you know, as they sort of went through the booths and they'd see it. This one guy came and he sat down and he was, you know, probably about this tall. You know, he was a pretty short guy and he was an older guy. He sat down and he was sitting there by himself and he watched that movie so intensely. And, you know, we were kind of curious as to, what is it that is attracting his interest here? You know, it's not the kind of movie you would just sort of casually sit down at. And afterwards, he said to my husband, I can relate to this. I can relate to this. Tall men have all the power. So I thought, okay, that's a good, interesting way of, sort of developing some empathy here. So, you know, so we tend to think that white men in this country have power, you know, and, you know, that's true. I mean, that's to a certain extent it isn't, but to a certain extent in a larger framework, men tend to control all of our institutions. And that's where sexism, that's where we sort of intersect this notion of sexism and racism, that we sort of recognize that in a general sense, okay? So is that all, are those the only people that have power in institutions?
The wealthy have power.
Okay. So wealthy have power, men have power. Okay. So does anybody else, is that?
Well, people who are well educated.
Okay.
Or those who finish school.
Okay. Okay. So you could probably create sort of a hierarchy of who has power and sort of. So where do you all think you fit on this hierarchy of who has power, who doesn't have power? Like this and this. You say 10 here and 1 here. Where would most of you think you fit?
8.
Okay.
Not wealthy, but
7.
I'm a graduate student.
So you'll get there. You'll get to 8, but maybe not 10.
Well, maybe.
What else? Where do other people think they are?
Well, if we use just those categories, that'd be a 10. But I'm gay.
Okay.
So put me
so
way
down. Put you down. Okay. All right. Yeah. So we do this exercise where we sort of read these statements and ask people to sort of walk and then stop and sort of figure out. We use all of these categories. And yeah, there are all these things that keep us, many of us, from having ultimate institutional power in the society, and there are some that are way down here. And people of color see themselves way down here, even though they may have
wealth.
They may be men.
Even age comes in there. When you get old, they think you're no longer going to use.
Any use, at least in this country, because there are some countries where that's not, mm-hmm. where that's not the case. Okay. So, but overall, there, you know, overall, most of you have sort of expressed that there's, somewhere up here, there's, you have some institutional power, because you have sort of these things that give you sort of institutional power. And if you sort of look at individual power, well, you know, if you've got force, if you, you know, all that kind of stuff, you may have more. I want to stop and think about what I want to say about that.
Who's so down what? The bottom? I mean, who do you think is down the bottom?
I would say
kids and mentally ill.
I mean, that would be a category I would put at the bottom. I mean, you know, obviously there would be others down there, but I mean that, you know, because, I mean, it, of all the things that you've said, this is where the line draws, right? And maybe black, poor, lesbian women, I mean, you know, let's add single mothers those things. That, you know, I'm one that believes that oppression, I think somebody said this in the video, oppression is oppression. It operates the same. We just tend to use different categories. And those who experience all of these categories experience a sort of multiple layers of oppression, and, you know, sort of depending on times in our history, you know, that is tends to be true. Well, I guess the point I'm trying to make is that when I think about racism, I'm thinking about a system. I'm using sort of a systemic definition about racism that says that institutions operate on behalf of a certain group of people in this society. And whether you think you have institutional power or not, that these institutions still operate to serve certain groups of people. And, you know, you're talking about, you're thinking that you have the ability to change. Well, individually, you may not have the ability to change institutions, but they still operate on what they think is your best interest. And one of the things that I find really interesting in the movie said, well, if you got rid of all black people in this country, then you might have to sort of deal with poor whites who think they've gotten something on people of color because they're not black. And the reality is they may see, wait a minute, I don't have institutional power either. I mean, I think this whole system of racism has sort of kind of duped us all into thinking that there is sort of this pecking order. And I do believe that there are folks who are on 10. I mean, I don't believe in conspiracy theories sometimes. Sometimes I do. But I think sort of there is, I mean, I think institutions are self-perpetuating, and they self-perpetuate the divisions in our society, whether we give them the power to do that or not. I mean, just by the mere fact that it's so difficult to change them and that they operate in our name, sometimes without our permission. And so if you sort of think about institutionally, when were most of the institutions in this country created? Did you want to
say? Oh, yeah. I work in education, and I see, I've been working in Oakland, and our schools just don't get the funding that other school districts get. We just don't have the tax base. And now we've got a nominal Democratic governor, and he's going to give graduates of high school who do really well merit scholarships. Well, there's no way our kids are ever going to get merit scholarships. So that, to me, seems like institutional.
It's such a vicious cycle that the institutions just operate and continue to operate. And, you know, historically, since 1492, well, whatever, we have sort of tried to make changes, but it just kind of sort of forms itself and works against.
But when I hear a word like merit, I sometimes it's like a buzzword to racism.
Mm-hmm. And there are lots of those.
Yeah.
Lots of those words. But again, most of our institutions were created while, say, racism was legal in this country. So if you think of all the major institutions in society, major ones, not little minor ones, people always like to use the, you know, drug cartel as an institution. Well, That's a major institution.
What about banking?
Banking. Banking institutions.
Yeah.
You know, what do banks do?
They red give line. Loans and they don't give them to some people.
That's right. They redline. And they redline now in ways that they didn't redline 10 years ago when they used to literally have a red line that they put around a map.
Yeah.
I think it was out in California that they were, the sort of the newer version of redlining was, is the use of the caller ID, where many companies were getting caller ID so that they could look at the area code of where their calls were coming from and decide whether or not they wanted to deliver pizzas in those areas. That's another form of redlining. We're not going to go into this neighborhood because we're not going to serve that community. We do a whole morning on looking at racism as it disempowers people of color. And we use all of those examples of how institutions disempower people of color. And again, you know, the hour is a setup because I can't really go into that. But you take that example and extend that to all other institutions. Doesn't mean that we don't like institutions, because we wouldn't be connected to them if we disliked them. But we know that most institutions were created prior to 1954, prior to 1965, when we made racism illegal. Prior to that time, it was legal in this country for every institution to be racist against people of color, just by the signs, colored, white, or whatever the term was that they used. So, in sort of thinking about racism, we have to look at how the institutions continue to perpetuate this difference in power based upon skin color. And so that's kind of what this whole sort of racial definition denotes. But it doesn't, again, mean that people don't have the power to act in ways that are racially discriminating and harmful. But we know that people of color don't have institutional power in the bigger scheme of things. You know, and we can cite lots of examples in the little scheme of things. But in the bigger scheme, and people always ask me, well, what about Colin Powell? He's probably the most powerful black man in the United States. Colin Powell becomes, what was he, Joint Chiefs of Staff or something? So Colin Powell says, you know, we're gonna end the embargo on Cuba because I think it's discriminatory to an island that's predominantly an island of people of color, of African descent. And it's hurting the people. How much power do you think Colin Powell would have to do that? He acts on behalf of the institution, not on behalf of himself as an individual. So what he thinks as an individual makes no difference because there are institutions that back and support him. So again, sort of this whole idea that racism, a lot of people, we spend a lot of time in our training talking about the difference between personal prejudice and racism, because I think that's a place where people are really stuck. Because now when we have rising crime rates and we see cross-racial incidents happening all the time, it clouds our vision in terms of what's really happening in this country. And it's very easy for that to move us off looking at what the real issues and the real problems are. And I don't say that, and I say that to say that people of color in this country have as much ability to be individually hurtful and harmful, but they don't have institutional power. Institutions don't serve the interests ultimately of people of color. So, what about this notion of race? What is race? What is your race?
I'm said to be Caucasian. The police ask me that when I call them, and it makes me mad. I refuse to answer.
Okay.
I'm Caucasian.
Okay. What's your race?
I'm Hispanic.
Hispanic. Okay. Anybody else? What's your race? I can't see you over there.
I'm Caucasian.
Caucasian. Okay. Anybody else? What's my race? I already told you.
I learned a new definition.
You want to tell us?
having a hard time.
Race is
okay.
Hard for the living.
I was a pastor in the Eskimo village of Shishmaref for 3 years. And what I discovered was that Native people in Alaska, and to a certain extent across Canada, although lesser, this kind of definition lessens as you go east in Canada. And I really don't know if it has much impact among Native people in the continental US. But Alaskan peoples tend to define race in terms of culture instead of genetic.
Okay.
And therefore, assimilation is a real possibility, which has never been the case on a genetic definition of race. So that genetically, I'm white. Culturally, I tend not to be functioning quite that way. And most Native people will look at me after a while and say, "Are you half?"
Can somebody again tell me what time it is?
4:35.
Not quite. Yeah. I was going to say humanoids.
Okay.
I don't think on our chromosomes there's a gene that says, you know, black, white. It's all just, you know what it is. You know? So. I come back to that issue again, that the whole idea of race needs to be deconstructed.
So we all society says we all have a race, and on our census form we don't yet have human race, but we all have a race, and we all have a race that we check off, right? On the census form, and some people don't. Some people say, "I can't, I won't, I resist it." But we all sort of have a race. And I find it interesting because in the year 1950, we had different categories than we had in the year 2000.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting? Is it that we're getting clearer about different races? And so we're sort of creating more categories? I mean, since when was Hispanic a race?
Well, that's interesting though, because always the census, especially like the church census, will ask other Caucasians, and they'll put Hispanics in a separate category.
They usually say on the census, what do they say? Hispanic, not black.
They have Latino, they have Chicano, they have Mexican, they have Caucasian. I don't know what to pick.
They have in many places you see Hispanic, not black. I find that really interesting because my husband is Puerto Rican, so that would make him Hispanic, or at least that he wouldn't define himself as that, but that's what the category. So he's Puerto Rican, and I'm African American. So what does that make our children? Hispanic, not black.
Well,
we can check more than one.
But you're mixing race with what is considered the next definition of national background or ethnicity.
But that's not what it says on the form. On the form it says race.
So we all
have a race. I mean, somebody has decided that we all have a race. Maybe we haven't decided that, but somebody has decided that we have a race. But we can't define what it is. What is it? What is race? You said that in Alaska there's more of a cultural understanding of race. That cultural understanding is juxtaposed against sort of what we consider to be kind of more of a genetic understanding. So, what is race? What is it?
It's a cultural construct.
Uh-huh.
Well, I think that in its original idea, it must have referred to continents of origin or so. I mean, it seems to me like there's the African continent.
Then what, so we have an African race?
Well,
what are the races? What if you use that as the sort of,
I don't know whether it works anymore because we're far away from where.
So what were the races? What did you learn with the races when you were in school?
You learned Caucasian.
Okay, so we had the Caucasian, which was the Caucasoid. I mean, how many of you remember learning about the Sepoids, right?
Yeah.
Caucasoids, and then what else?
Negroid.
We had the Negroid. Okay. And we had the Mongoloid.
Oh my goodness.
Oh, jeez. And what else did we have?
Indians, Asians.
And what were they called? And then they lumped everybody else into this category of the Australoids.
Ah, okay.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Okay. So we all had, and they all sort of were based upon land. Sort of land based. But I'm just curious as where the Negroid land was.
Well, I think it's supposed to be Africa, but there are others.
But, you know, I mean, it's like, that's, I don't know where Negro land is. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Caucasus land is Caucasus Mountains.
Yeah.
You know, Mongoloid, Mongolia, right?
Yeah.
Australia. I mean, so it is kind of based on land. But this is kind of an odd one out.
Well, yeah.
Was it from the word black?
In Latin, yes.
Yeah.
Well, the fact that it doesn't make sense should alert us to something.
Exactly. I mean, that's what the point is. It doesn't make any sense. However, it's still something very real.
Right.
It still exists as if it is really real. And I would say that it still exists in the minds of probably 90% of our country, that it has some biological basis to it, some genetic reality to it. I asked my daughter, you know, what race was did she sort of identify my granddaughter as? Because my granddaughter's father is Mexican, and her mother is my daughter. And so we asked her, well, what is she? And she sort of says, well, on her birth certificate is, I think she has black on the birth certificate or African American. When she went to the clinic, they put Mexican on there. And I said, who did that? Who put that on there?
Yeah.
She didn't put it on there. Somebody else put it on there. And so we sort of go through this little exercise of trying to define what race is Jasmine. And you sort of get all the way back to as far back as we can identify in terms of our ancestry, and what Jasmine was back then bears no relationship to how people categorize Jasmine now.
I think what race has become is kind of society's way of looking at people.
Uh-huh.
It's just become a face value, as this is what African Americans look like, well, this is what a Hispanic looks like, and I think that's kind of how it's looked at now. There's no really definition behind it.
In spite of the fact that we're all capable of reproducing with each other, and so increasingly we get Jasmines.
That's right. Mm-hmm. But somebody else is making the decision. You know, that's power. I mean, that's really power. Somebody else is deciding, and not only deciding what race you are, but deciding what gets attached to that.
Mm-hmm.
What's the meaning of that? And the meaning of race, when was race first invented? When did we first think about race? Or when was race?
I haven't got a clue about that, but my guess would be about someplace about the 18th century or something.
When people started to mix.
People started to mix.
That's been going on forever.
Forever. Maybe 15th century.
But the noise starts in the 18th, 19th century when you start to study anthropologically the races and get all these theories about what makes people the way they are and why and then you can pull in, because my group, whatever it is, has got all the good characteristics, and my group writes the books, and my group makes the decisions, and that defines the good group, and then everybody else is defined over against.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me in Western history, probably colonialism was probably one of the sources.
Was race in the Bible? Okay, who are the Bible people in the room?
Shem, Ham, and Japheth.
Okay, and what was the race? I mean, what was the?
Well, I mean, the tradition, of course, is that the sons of Noah become the races of, I don't know why. It's,
but the interpretation.
Well, that's the all that we've got left after the flood.
Yeah. Now, you know what I find interesting, and I hadn't thought about this until maybe a couple weeks ago, when I realized the Bible that we use is the King James Version. Well, you know, and what has come after that, right?
Yeah.
But it's all based upon the King James Version. When was King James the king?
1611.
And what was going on during that time?
But the newer ones are not based on King James. They're based on original manuscripts from...
But we, for a long time, that was the sacred document,
yeah,
right? And, right, you know, people sort of... But, you know, it was like the 1600s. What was going on? Colonization was going on. So, you know, I mean, I don't trust King James's version. I mean, nobody else does either, because they keep changing it. But sort of, you know, all of this was sort of happening around the 1600s when the Europeans were colonizing. And they did come in contact maybe with people that they hadn't seen before. They're sort of creating these categories based upon what they saw and based upon what they wanted. So, you know, we come to America, we see Native Americans. Oh, they look different. Oh, they're different. They got something that we want. We've got to justify that. And so sort of this whole institutionalization of this concept of race began to happen. I mean, you know, obviously people were different, looked different before 1619 or 1610, but that wasn't necessarily the basis of dividing people. You know, it might have been ethnicity, religion, a lot of other ways, but not necessarily race. And it was like in the 1600s that we began to see the institutionalization of the notion of race. And we saw it in some very, very, very specific kinds of ways, not just in our minds. We saw it in the laws that were created. The very first police system in the United States was created as a way to control the slaves. Now, if we're talking about institutionalization of racism, it is quite interesting to me that we have all this conflict in the year 2000 between people of color and our police systems. And people assume that happened yesterday. Well, if a whole institution was created with the express purpose of controlling slaves and protecting property, those institutions don't change easily. I mean, they have some progress, but, you know, sort of the basis or the foundation still holds remnants of why those institutions were created in the first place. So our policing system, the first laws about who could own land and who couldn't own land happened in the 1600s. And the laws that said slaves could not.
Women could not.
Women could not.
Landless could not.
Could not. And that's where we began to see sort of race creeping into our founding documents in society. That's what institutionalization is all about. It's not just about what images come to our mind, but it's about how we build it into the very framework of who we are and what our identity as people are.
And yet the concept of a police system is coming then from Europe, where it didn't, at least prior to that, have a racist connotation, so that the institutions may be of ancient age, but the concept of racial power becomes our unique contribution.
Exactly. Become something that gets shaped and reformed in the United States and then gets exported again around the world. You know, we sort of, and so, you know, yesterday we were, you know, you have sort of this tongue-in-cheek feeling about the 4th of July, you know, and sort of like it's rah, 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 but on the other hand, it's like, okay, in 1776, who were not citizens? Who could not be citizens? That's right. So, you know, there's something, you know, interesting about, you know, sort of how we sort of think about that. Now, I'm not leaving this country.
Right. And the good side is that we've made some progress.
Absolutely. Who was it? There was a guy here who last week who said to me, I think it was Mississippi. It was either Mississippi or Alabama. Just abolished slavery. Within
Mississippi, quite recently. They were waiting to be recompensed. They wanted to be paid for property lost.
Mm-hmm. The Mississippian in power? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, in our laws, I mean, there's an example of sort of how race is built into our laws, you know, built into who could marry and who couldn't marry. My parents were married in 1950. My mother's white and my father's black. They were married. It was illegal for them to be married in 1950, so they broke the law and could be held accountable for that. And it's just recently that those laws have been overturned. In 1972, a white woman wanted to travel around the world and hadn't traveled. It was the first time she's going to travel to Europe and went to get her passport. You know, when you get your passport, you have to have your birth certificate. She hadn't gotten her birth certificate. She got her birth certificate, and on her birth certificate, it said that she was colored. She go to get her passport, and she puts down race, and she puts down white, and they say, I'm sorry, ma'am, your passport. This was in Louisiana. You know who's in Louisiana? Remember who's in Louisiana?
Yeah.
David Duke. So folks like David Duke in Louisiana. So they say, ma'am, you can't have your passport because you're lying on your application. And she says, well, I'm white. Well, your birth certificate says that you're not. So she takes it to court to fight it. She loses in the local courts. She takes it to the Supreme Court. And she loses in the Supreme Court. This is in the 70s. And the Supreme Court says the states have a right to decide racial categories. So in Louisiana, if you're 1/16th, if you have 1/16th of African blood in you, you're considered black. Whereas you can cross the border and go to Mississippi and you only have to have 1/32nd. Blood in order to be. So, I mean, it just doesn't make sense. But how deeply ingrained in our laws and then even in our minds, this notion of race lives with us to this day. And, you know, how do we work ourselves out of, how do we work ourselves out of this? I mean, Alaska may have some ancestors here. You know, there may be some answers, but, you know, we were discussing the other day about sort of, what is the solution to this? If we are still, I mean, and every day people work to justify why race is a valid category to separate people in the society. And I think what happens more now is that it's connected to notions of class. So all these studies about IQ, the bell curve, all of these studies, all these scientific studies that really are really race-based notions about why people are different. It is so deeply ingrained in us that, you know, I don't know what you do to get rid of it. Because even if you get rid of the categories, you have to have hundreds of years of intermarriage before we sort of get to that place, but
if the federal government stopped honoring the concept of race, you know, that's an interesting question. Would that be possible?
Mm-hmm.
What would be the cost of doing that? But it reminds me a lot of the arguments about getting rid of segregation, you know, with Plessy versus Ferguson, when that was finally knocked down, is that when the government itself puts its imprimatur on something like that, that creates a problem for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just remember reading something, I think even within the last couple of days, about I wish I could remember it. I wish I had noted it. The real conservative wing of this country is fighting for sort of this colorblind notion, this notion of a colorblind society. And I, you know, I'm like, okay.
But what are these?
Okay. Let's think about them. That's right. What's in it for them? Well, let's get rid of affirmative action. Let's get rid of all these policies that look like they help or serve people of color at the expense of white people. So, you know, if we have a colorblind society, then we don't, you know, we don't have to, you know, it'll eliminate all of those preferences. So you've got on the conservative side, you've got all of that, and then you've got sort of on this other side, I don't know if you could call it conservative or progressive, people of color who are saying, we don't want to get rid of these racial categories. I was in Minnesota a couple of, is anybody here from Minnesota? Minnesotans, do you know Kirk Colvin? Are you familiar with Kirk Colvin, Minnesota? God, I cannot believe people don't know that little town. I was in Minnesota a couple months ago, and you know, there's all these private prisons coming up all over the place. And Kirk Colvin, or at least the county of where Kirk Colvin has one of these new privatized prisons. You know, where the government is getting out of the prison business and giving it to private groups to run. And it was the first time I had heard that these little community, you know, every little community in the world wants a prison now, right?
Nobody wants a prison.
Oh. A lot of rural areas do, because they provide jobs.
I mean, in Illinois, they were going to build a state prison, and they were out campaigning. I mean, with banners and hats and campaigning to get this prison built in their community because. I mean, right. I mean, it's an income producing for that community. And so in this little community where there's no people of color at all. Well, I shouldn't say that there are no black people because they're Native Americans and they're new Hmong community moving in Minnesota, lots of little communities. But here this community all of a sudden now has 2,000 more people of color than it had at the last census. Now, what do you think that does for a community? I mean, here we have some race-based sort of advantages, so to speak. I don't know if I'd call them advantages, some opportunities. And here you have a community that is claiming, and the federal government allows that to happen. You can do the census, you're allowed to count everyone who lives in your community as part of your community. Now, those 2,000 people don't have the right to vote because they're incarcerated. However, that little community has a right to add those people to its roles. I mean, so now we sort of start to shape this picture that looks very different than it did 10 years ago or 20 years ago, just based on this notion of race and the advantages that people can take for using this category now. So, I mean, it's just, I don't know. I don't know where it ends. And I don't know what to do about it.
Well, let's go back to the beginning. That when the concept of race as we currently find it constructed in our society started, you're looking at my group, my ability to preserve power because I'm the good group, looking at all other groups as not as good, and perhaps making hierarchy out of it. But if we come to a conclusion then that race is a cultural construct, can we segue over to the diversity and the culture, cultural understandings and the possibilities of assimilation and change?
Okay, well, I know our time is up and this is not a good time to stop. But the question I want you to leave with is then, if that be the case, then if we sort of say, first of all, race is not culture. However, we're trying to move towards sort of an understanding of sort of different cultural experiences. Then what does white mean? What does it mean to be white? We know what it means to be black, or Latino or Asian, because we have all of these stereotypes that we've created over the years, right? So we have all those images. So what is it?
In many forms which you fill out, I'm now other. In other words, if I'm not Latino or Filipino or African American, et cetera, et cetera, there's no, you keep going and the only thing that's left is other.
Mm-hmm. Is there still a Caucasian? Now, I don't know what you
call those yourself. Categories, there isn't, yeah.
But is there a Caucasian category? There still is
in
a white category.
It
seems to me almost in America, that's a really difficult thing because it's all mixed up with Northern European heritage. Mm-hmm. And it's been so
is
what?
So is white Swedish? Is a white the same as Swedish?
No.
No.
Okay. But Swedish is white. Right. Yeah. Unless they're a Laplander and then they're what? Mm-hmm. Then
Well, unknown.
Let me just say just a couple of things in terms of where I'm going with this in the next couple of days. I wanted to get us to a discussion of whiteness today and to sort of think about what that means in relationship to color. If you sort of look at people of color, then what does it mean to be white? So I might start there a little bit tomorrow, but I also have a really good video that I'm going to show tomorrow. It's called The Way Home. And it is a group of women in different racial ethnic groups talking about their experiences in that group. So I'm going to show part of it tomorrow and then part of it the next day. And what I plan to do is have maybe 15 minutes each day for some discussion about it. So I hope you all come back.
Good. Thank you. I'm going to be down late tomorrow. But
oh.
I have one.
Okay.
I know. I've been told people take it out before it's dry.
Maybe there needs to be, maybe it's a matter of, I consider my whiteness my vulnerability to sunburn. That's the major thing that I'll say.
Right.
I describe my ethnic background as Scotch, Irish, English, Welsh, German, and all the things.
You must be related to my mother, because I think she's all of those.
Yeah, I mean, it's just awful. But when I went to Augustana College, they left me a space this big, and it was just enough space to write Swedish. Well, so I put it all around the edge. Nobody ever called me in and said, you made a mess of this card. But it really focused on how much the college in those days expected everybody to fit into that neat little piece. Okay.
But one of my most traumatic racial experiences as a little girl was I must have been in third or fifth grade, probably fifth grade, and we had to write an essay. And I wrote an essay, and my essay was, I don't understand why white people don't like Black people because they spend so much time in the summertime trying to get brown. And my teacher gave me a D and said to me, it has nothing to do with changing color. It has to do with protecting the skin. And it was devastating to me because
it was a stupid remark.
It was, and I thought, I've since sort of thought more about it, but I thought, okay, she didn't get it.
Yeah, she didn't get it.
She didn't get it.
Yeah. Well, I went to New Guinea for 2 years, and my students followed me around with a big banana leaf. They'd be in back of me, but this great big banana leaf, and then their explanation is too white.
Too white.
And the other thing, maybe we gotta, instead of these now, maybe we gotta have a division is by virtue of whether your hair is curly or straight. Because that was the other thing, they used to feel my hair. They'd feel the hair and they'd say, too straight.
Too straight.
I loved it. So then one time.
Well, you get rid of this and we have something else. So it's sort of like, how do you figure out how to eliminate it all so we don't substitute one for the other?
I really like being in Los Angeles because of the diversity. I came up here for my Midwestern little experience for summer, but it really makes me mad as a pastor of my church, I call the police department, not terribly often, but whenever I do, the police want to know
how, what my age is and what my race is. Mm-hmm. And I refuse to tell them. Mm-hmm. This is none of your business. Come over and look at me if you want to, but I'm reporting a crime. I don't know. I don't even know the race of the perpetrator, or nor the age of the perpetrator. This is what happened, mm-hmm. you know. And they want. There's something that there's something really awful about the way the police insist upon this as a defining, you know, whether what could they tell if I told them my race? Mm-hmm. Would it be that they would believe my report more, or what? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just find this, you know, in systems like the police is so much more entrenched. I mean,
yeah.
It just keeps getting more and more and more and more entrenched.
I'm just furious.
And I think, you know, the more and more we sort of get fearful of the society that we live in, the more we give permission to the police to do that.
Well, I mean, I know.
And so it's like, okay, how do we sort of, in the end, to me, the more and more and more we have crime, is a function of racism.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a function of the haves and the have-nots, and how we divide society, and how people act that out. So it's like, duh.
I'll have to talk to you about this new thing that I think the church is doing. And I don't know why. I mean, a couple of my black sisters, clergy sisters, don't see it, and I don't know if it's my blindness that I don't see what they're seeing, but I see it as racism, and it's another case in which. Because it's politically correct to be Hispanic now. Mm-hmm. I mean, or actually, it is it's politically expedient for the church to try to get the Hispanic population. Mm-hmm. And so again, the black community, students and everything have been shoved aside in favor of Hispanic and Asian churches being started. And I keep talking about it, and I think, well, maybe better shut up and let somebody else, love person of color, define it. But I'm just short of being absolutely sure that this is another case that the church is going to say, well, this alternate route to seminary. Mm-hmm. It used to be for people of color, but now we don't care about people of color. We'll go for the Asians. Mm-hmm. That's where there's more money there, and you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. So I'll try to be quiet, but
yeah,
I won't be quiet.
You know, and it's sort of like trying to, you know, and I, you know, I don't think any of us are. I think the problem is that none of us feel particularly articulate in understanding the phenomena and being able to talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, you sort of feel it, but you don't. You know, because we're so skittish about talking about race.
Oh yeah, yeah.
That it. Unless you know what you're talking about, you're not going to talk about it because it doesn't move you. And that's why it's a lot easier to talk about cultural diversity, because it is a nice, warm, fuzzy stuff. But I think that you can't really get to true cultural diversity until you start dealing with why we're separated in the first place.
But the whole thing about this country is that we are so mixed up. Yeah, even if we think we're not as mixed up as we are. We're so mixed up, but that is causing a great deal of discomfort, and that's why you have people insisting now that they have more categories on the census, mm-hmm. because they've had it with the government saying there are only four categories, or there are only six categories, mm-hmm. or something. And I mean, I can remember when I taught school, we had to do this, and it never occurred to me that I could stand up and say, I will not do it. Mm-hmm. But I mean, so you try to do it with some integrity. And I suppose that also helped the school, mm-hmm. because if you had a certain amount of people of Native American, or you know, that you may have gotten more money, mm-hmm. from the school or whatever.
Well, the first system of census was designed to count the difference between blacks in America and whites, and that was those were the only two categories. I think they were considered white without
animals.
Power.
I think they were considered animals. Mm-hmm. Not, you know, I mean, you could go out and shoot an Indian, it's okay. Jeez, mm-hmm. pretty awful.
So we've come a long ways, but I think have we really come? You know, what is the function of it in the first place, and does it serve? Whose function does it serve? And it's so confusing of a conversation to have.
Well, I mean,
I don't know how to have it.
It's really hard. Yeah. Well, I spent two years in New Guinea, and they are Melanesian. They're Melanesians. They have Negroid. There are all kinds of Negroid features. That is very black skin. Mm-hmm. But I mean, if you want to talk about racial characteristics, and there are some. I mean, scientifically, certain bones are longer, or A-type blood, or O-type blood, or you know.
Right.
I mean, there really there's nothing that isn't visual. You can't say, oh wow, an O-type blood walking down the street.
Exactly.
You know, but the Melanesian part comes from. You know, the Pacific Islands, there's obviously, and many of them are less black, more honey colored.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them are not as light as you,
mm-hmm.
but slightly darker.
Mm-hmm.
And the mountain people are very dark by comparison to the coastals, but more intermixing of marriage mm-hmm. there. And the people on the wealthiest part of the island, which is where the copper mines are, they're very black. And in fact, the New Guineans themselves, my students would say, that person from that island is too black.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, it's this pecking order there. And where did they learn that? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it makes a white person very nervous to hear New Guineans discriminate between shades of darkness in their own race. But they also have this tribalism that's just incredible. I mean, I don't know whether they even have a notion of race, but they certainly have a notion of your talk place. This is your place. And traditionally, everyone outside of that is mm-hmm. not, is less than. Mm-hmm. And what that does is focus on how much we use our language and our visual thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you didn't have to be there very long before you could say, oh, you're from the Osmot tribe.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I could do that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I didn't spend that much time there to really earn my right to be able to do that, but it was so clear
mm-hmm.
because a certain nose characteristic or a certain head shape
mm-hmm.
would be very, very obvious,
mm-hmm.
and you could tell.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know. It's a really funny thing.
But we do. I mean, in lots of those places, they make, in lots of other countries, they make divisions that are not strictly race. We do export the notion of race around the world.
Yeah.
And we make something of it. I mean, we create the ways of looking at it and export it around the world. I was in Minnesota not too long ago, and we were working with the Somali community. They have no concept of race in their country. It's religious to fit. I mean, they're, you know, homogeneous country, and so for them to come to the United States, they're much more concerned about religious differences. And so you try to get them to understand race, it's like,
they're going to eat the difference?
No, I've got to go try something.
No,
actually, there's a buffet out there.
Is there a buffet today? Oh,
yeah.
Good. Well, let me tell you another interesting thing that happened in New Guinea. Because they're so late in getting even birth certificates. I mean, I had lots of students that didn't know when they were born. And I was only there, I was there in 73 to 5. So one of the things, they achieved their statehood, or their nationhood, so to speak. And they had this big fight, incredible fight, about who had the right to vote.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who was a citizen of Papua New Guinea? Well, they had certain political figures saying, you had to prove that you were, you know, you're back sixth gen. Well, none of them could prove six generations. There was no history.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing written down. There were no, you know, there just was no record. So you could, and they argued and argued. They said, everybody can be here except the Japanese. They hated the Japanese because the Japanese were there in the war and they tore up their gardens and raped their women. Da 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 da. You know, the Chinese could be there because they had trade stores that helped the people. And then they finally threw that out too because there's a Japanese guy in their parliament. You know, so finally they said, well, anybody could be a citizen as long as you did not oppose the government and you were there to support and uphold the laws. So that was just, I mean, it just disintegrated because they couldn't, get a handle mm-hmm. on the defining factors mm-hmm. of what it meant to be a New Guinean. That was really great.
That's what we just had ended up, two black children. They were refused to call, meaning they called them, so they wouldn't take them because they had two black children and they were afraid that those black children would either get involved with their own kids, you know, so afraid of that mix. Yeah. You know, I think that's so sad.
Well, and of course, there are all kinds of people that now would say, well, these black children shouldn't be raised by whites, or a black family shouldn't raise a white child. I think that we've...
And I think all of those, wherever you stand on that scale, it all comes back to sort of how we have racialized the society. So a black child living in a white home, what do they do? How do they get a sense of who they are when the definition of who you are comes from outside of you?
And furthermore, it's based on color.
It's right, you know. And so it's like we've got to have a different way to configure.
That's what I say, straight and curly hair, and then we could just confound them all because some people still curl their hair.
Even if it's straight when it's they wake up in the morning.
But I gave that up because I went down to New Guinea with an absolutely fresh permit, and I'd had it for about 1 week, and it lasted about a week there. I mean, forget it. It won't last in humid weather, so you just say, I give up. I'm going to be satisfied with straight hair.
If I had thicker hair, I'd let it be straight. But I envy you. You're not supposed to envy, but I love your curly hair.
Yeah, well, I love books about hair because we all got a thing about our hair, right?
Yeah.
It's not ever quite what we want it to be, right?
No. In some perfect heaven, I will have curly hair.
Right. Or even skin, the fact that you go out and get a good suntan.
Right.
You don't want to be what you are.
There's just, it's just, we all
dull blonde, that's what I call it.
Mousy is what I call mine, but, and my black, I've had three black students that I've helped to mentor in this Theological Education for Emerging Ministries program. And of the three, two of them are superb. The other one really probably should not be in ministry, but that was difficult. That was a difficult thing for me to say because that was the male. Mm-hmm. And that synod wants to push the male through. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're more interested in having a man. Mm-hmm. And I think, well, that's sort of an interesting piece of prejudice there too, you know. So the guy doesn't have any brains and can't put a sentence together, but we're going to work our butts off to get him through. But the two women who are very sharp mm-hmm. Don't get the same kind of treatment. But anyway, of those two, the first one, Charlene, I am so much alike. She and I are so much alike that people didn't, I mean, they couldn't think of us as being alike because she's black and I'm white, but in fact, we're both teachers and we think that way. And I mean, there are just all kinds of ways that we both like music and love to sing, all kinds of stuff. So, I mean, we have a great repartee going, and the congregation, I think, had a good lesson in how that race or color is not particularly the best distinguishing feature, that there are other things that make people interesting mm-hmm. besides that. And the other interesting thing is that she was an officer for the IRS, so one sharp cookie. And she was used to she was very used to working within any racial group, within any group period, so that she had a lot of exposure to different ethnic groups in Los Angeles. So she felt comfortable mm-hmm. in all those things. But I think it's interesting that the church would not help her get a congregation that was really racially mixed. Mm-hmm. They put her in the inner city mm-hmm. There's a few remnant whites in the Virginia community. And I think she's
well, if that's not institutional power.
Of course it is. Of course it is. And she could have been that bridge mm-hmm. that would have been able to be in a white community, or a like West, like where I am, West LA, which is more multicultural because of UCLA, mm-hmm. than most communities, and an educated community, so language is the distinguishing yeah. feature. But it's been fun.
Yeah.
I wish
Are you leaving tomorrow?
I'm leaving tomorrow. Oh. Yeah. But I'll keep the name of the video and see if I can get it. Yeah. Is it in Church Resource or is it in a